From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson at the Tech de Monterrey in Mexico City today.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start in the States, in Arkansas, where another execution of a death row inmate is scheduled to take place tonight. 38-year-old convicted murderer Kenneth Williams is the fourth of eight inmates the state wanted to execute by the end of the month before its supply of a capital punishment drug expired. Four of those men won reprieves, so this is the last execution for now. AP reporter Andrew DeMillo witnessed the first of two back-to-back executions earlier this week. We'll ask him about that. He joins us now from Little Rock. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kenneth Williams being put to death tonight, he was serving a life sentence for killing cheerleader Dominique Hurd. He taunted her family after he got the life sentence and not death. Then he killed two other people after escaping prison in a barrel of hog slop. But we understand he has appeals out today. Based on what?
It's based on multiple issues. The latest appeal that we've seen filed in state court today is actually dealing with the method of execution itself. His attorneys are raising questions about the double execution that occurred earlier this week of Jack Jones and Marcel Williams, and raising concerns about the process that happened with that and some of the differing accounts of what happened, at least with Jack Jones.
Well, that was the execution that you witnessed of Jack Jones Monday night. First of two inmates executed that night. Witnesses say they saw different things. Some said he appeared to speak after the drugs were administered. Another said he gasped and gurgled. What do you say?
Immediately after he completed his final statements, the microphone was turned off, and I could see his lips moving. I'd say for about a minute. Since the microphone was off, it was unclear whether or not he was speaking or what he was doing by moving his lips. Mm. However, were other witnesses who testified before a federal judge that evening after Jones's execution, who said that they saw his mouth move about 5 minutes into the execution, open and close, and there was some dispute about what that meant. Attorneys mm-hmm. for Marcel Williams, who was the second inmate executed that night, had argued that it was a sign that Jones's execution was inhumane and torturous.
Because there isn't supposed to be movement 5 minutes after this execution drug is administered. So, first of all, two things. It must have been tough to witness that. But tonight, Kenneth Williams is scheduled to be put to death. Is the thinking that his appeals might have any merit?
I don't know. I can tell you based on the past week or so of these executions and planned executions, if those are any indication, it's still going to be a very fluid day. We're going to see a lot of legal action over the next several hours in both state and federal court, and likely leading all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The question is whether or not it will end up delaying or scrapping the execution altogether, whether or not it will see anything happening at the last minute. But based mm-hmm. on what we've seen from the past few nights of executions, we'll definitely see a lot more action and a lot more filings and wrangling over the day.
And just very briefly, Andrew, this is happening because the drug that's used in these capital punishments has expired. What happens going forward? Is the state going to get more? I mean, what happens?
And that's what's unclear. The state supply of midazolam expires, I believe, on Sunday at the end of the month, and the state has said it does not have another supply of the drug, and they've also said it's been very difficult to find a new supplier, even with a law they have in place that keeps the source of its lethal injection drug secret. So that's going to be the next question: is what are going to be the efforts on finding a new drug, and how quickly they'd be able to find it, if at all.
And much of it manufactured in Europe, and much of Europe against the capital punishment. Andrew DeMillo, capital correspondent for the Associated Press in Little Rock, Arkansas. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, here in Mexico City, one thing you don't see much of is water. No lakes or rivers flowing through the city. In fact, the city is in a water crisis. To hear more about that, we met with Pedro Moctezuma, the director of a group called Agua para Todos, Water for All. He took us to what's left of an ancient lake called Xochimilco, Hundreds of years ago, the Aztecs settled here and built islands on the water to grow food.
There were 12,000 hectares of the lake covered with these artificial islands, where there was a very intensive agriculture, and it produced fruits, vegetables, and flowers.
And we just heard a fish jump behind us. We're actually standing on a boat in the water right now. But the Mexico City that we see today is not filled with lakes and water. It's built on top of them.
Yeah. Yeah, because Tenochtitlan, the ancient capital, was invaded 498 years ago by Spaniards from southern Spain. They came from the desert. And Alexander Humboldt, the German scientist that came to Mexico in the early 19th century, was very puzzled because he says this Nueva España, New Spain, as it was called,
used to call Mexico New Spain.
It's puzzling that they are enemies of water. They say this is the only culture that I know that are enemies of water. So what they did from 1607 on was to drain the five lakes that covered the valley. And this process of draining Mexico City and sending water out is still going on. Every year, Mexico City government drains 80 million cubic meters of water out to the Gulf of Mexico.
Why?
Well, there is this historic bias against water or inability to deal with water cycles. I would call it like trauma, historic trauma. At this point, the new project is to build the Tunnel Emisor Oriente to get the water out of Mexico City to a plant called Atotonilco. And they have spent 54,000 million pesos in that project of draining the water out.
Now, one of the problems that has been caused by the fact that Mexico City is built on the top of lakes is that it is now sinking. Uh-huh. And if you go into some of the buildings in downtown, the cathedral even, it's leaning.
Yeah. Yeah, Mexico City is rapidly sinking, not only because of ancient practices, but also because currently we take two-thirds of our water from the aquifers.
Underneath the city.
Underneath the city. And they have, in the last century, the wells pumped water from 20 to 40 meters below. After that, they went into deeper wells, 400 meters. And now they are adventuring themselves with 2 kilometer deep wells that pump water at a really high cost. So this causes regional subsidence, regional sinking, especially in the eastern part of Mexico City.
You take the water out from underneath and everything else goes down a little bit.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that is a bit ironic about this situation is that Mexico City is trying to build on top of its water and get rid of its water. And at the same time, there are so many people here who don't have fresh water to drink.
Uh-huh. The water authority in Mexico City recognized that there is 1.6 million people in Mexico City with normal access to water. There is a huge inequality.
We should say there are some 20 million people in the metropolitan area.
Yeah. It affects health, education. Many of the schools have to close during February and March because of lack of water in the bathrooms.
So how do you make sense of this, this conundrum for this city, that you have water underground, but if you use it, the city will sink, and there aren't enough people getting water that need water?
Well, now what guides the government officials is short-term results. They play with scarcity. They exchange water for votes. all the political parties are in this perverse activity. And also big business wants to have a monopoly on water in Mexico City, because a huge business to sell bottled water to communities that don't have any water. No? So in the short term, there is big money being benefited from this, but in the long term, they are risking a total collapse of Mexico's capital.
That was Pedro Moctezuma with Agua para Todos, Water for All, at one of the few remaining lakes in Mexico City. And if you go to the U.S. Embassy here in Mexico City, you'll find lines of people trying to get to the United States. You'll also find people like Javier Rodriguez, who says he's been living in Alabama for 27 years and was arrested on a traffic violation. He was offered a choice: detention and forced deportation or voluntary deportation. He chose the latter and arrived here in Mexico just days ago.
I don't know. It's unbelievable. I don't know anything about Mexico right now. I've been for 27 years in the U.S. and I don't know where I am right here.
And you never got legal status during those 27 years?
No. The first time when I tried, I lost my case.
Do you have family still in the U.S.?
One daughter and one son living there, but it's too sad. It's unbelievable. I don't know this city, so...
Do you think that this has to do with Trump?
I think so. Yeah, I think so, because maybe... If he don't have all these political decisions or whatever, maybe I have more opportunities to stay in the United States.
President Trump's statements about immigration and about Mexico have upset many here, including the former foreign minister, Jorge Castañeda. We met at his apartment in Mexico City, and I asked him how he would describe the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico.
Lousy, in a word. Things have improved a little bit over the last month or so in the sense that President Trump and his administration either have stopped talking and stopped tweeting, or have said less nonsense or tweeted less nonsense in the last 6 weeks or so.
He's been tweeting this week about the wall.
Well, he started all over again with the wall. And so that's once again creating problems, particularly since the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, insinuated about a month and a half ago that he had reached an understanding, if not a deal, with President Trump to the effect that there would be no more tweeting or talking or anything about the wall. Well, if President Trump is tweeting about it again, that seems to mean that either that understanding did not exist or doesn't exist anymore.
Do you think President Trump has a way out of this, though? Is it possible for him at this point to save face without building the wall and having Mexico pay for it, as he's been saying?
Well, there are many ways of saving face for President Trump if he actually wants to do things and not just talk about them. I think the wall is an unfriendly, aggressive act against a friendly neighbor, which should not take place. The issue of who pays for it, I think, is totally secondary. That said, if the issue for Trump is how to present a way to the U.S. public of how Mexico pays for it, there are many ways, from a border crossing tariff that already exists, but raise it, to charging Mexicans more for visas. We pay about $160 for each visa now. If you double that or triple that over the next few years, you get some money for that. And then Mexicans choose to go or not to go.
Regardless of who pays for the wall, if the wall is actually built, what do you think that does to the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico?
It's enormously harmful. The people who say it doesn't matter do not know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're talking about, first of all, because of the symbolic nature of building a wall between two countries that have now been trying for the past 30 years or so to bring down the psychological, cultural, historical walls that have existed since the 19th century. Secondly, because in a series of communities, of transborder communities, this will make life much more complicated, much more difficult for people coming and going. And thirdly, because it will raise the cost of crossing without papers. It's not going to stop people from crossing the famous ladder, the 30-foot ladder or the 20-foot tunnel or what right. have you. The issue is not how deep the tunnel is dug. The issue is how much the smugglers, the polleros, charge for a more expensive and more dangerous and more risky crossing. They will charge more. The more they charge, the more lucrative the business becomes. The more lucrative it is, the more attractive it becomes for organized crime. So the wall is not inconsequential. It's silly to say it doesn't matter.
It seems like the three main problems that Trump and many of his supporters have with the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico right now would be, number one, jobs coming this way, going to Mexico. Number two, people coming illegally into the United States. And number three, drugs. And Trump has been mentioning the drug trade. What would you suggest, short of building a wall, that the U.S. should do about those things, which are upsetting a lot of people?
Well, on the jobs issue, it would be in the U.S.'s interest for more jobs, many more jobs from all over the world to come to Mexico. Why? Because the reason people go to the U.S. from Mexico, with or without papers, it's irrelevant from this point of view, is because there are not sufficiently good jobs here. And secondly, the reason Mexico is lackadaisical or corrupt or unwilling for good reason not to fight the U.S.'s ridiculous drug war or do its dirty work for it is because this still is a country with 50 million or so people who live in poverty. And so the best way to address those two issues is through more jobs coming to Mexico, better paying jobs. Now, what do you do with the people in the U.S. who lose their jobs? Well, what they should have done since NAFTA, which was training programs, substitution programs, educational programs, etc., special investments or special incentives for those areas of the United States where jobs were being lost. None of that ever happened, like it never happened in the 70s with other free trade agreements with the U.S. So there are ways of protecting people in the U.S. who lose their jobs, but the best way to address the other two problems that Americans have, and rightly so, immigration without papers and drugs, is to make Mexico more prosperous.
Do you think NAFTA is going to survive?
That's a tough one to call, because my impression is that Trump has to deliver on some of his promises to somebody. Perhaps the easiest thing he can deliver on is NAFTA, which is enormously important for Mexico, but is really not very important for the United States and never was. U.S. exports to Mexico are 1.5% of U.S. GDP. That's what we're talking about here. So at the end of the day, Trump may say, of all the things I promised, maybe the cheapest one to deliver on is NAFTA, because not that much would change anyway for the U.S. For Mexico, it's a big problem in the short term, because this would become a discouraging factor for foreign investment in Mexico.
We met a man this morning at the U.S. Embassy who was just deported from the United States a few days ago. He had been living in Alabama for 27 years, and he got a traffic stop. And he was asked, did he want to self-deport or did he want to be put into a detention center? And he decided to leave the country. He doesn't know much about living in Mexico. He hasn't been here in decades. What would you say to somebody like that?
Well, the first thing I would have said to him, and this is what the government and the Mexican private sector has to do, is a massive campaign in the United States, in Spanish, everywhere you can. If they give you the choice, say you want a hearing and a detention center, do not accept voluntary removal. Because once you accept it, you're done. You're toast. You have no recourse whatsoever. Secondly, get in touch with the consulate. You have the right to that. And immediately have the consulate give you a lawyer. And then start litigating, dragging it out. Because his choice, this gentleman's choice, is not between freedom in the U.S. with his family or 3 months in a horrible detention center. No. His choice is between a few months, perhaps, yes, in a horrible detention center or being sent back to Mexico and never being able to go back to the United States. That's his real choice. He doesn't know enough, probably, to make a decision, a well-informed decision, which is why we have to inform him of the fundamental nature of his decision.
I have one more question for you. You have spent a lot of time in the United States. What do you think is the biggest misconception Americans have about Mexico?
Well, I think they have a very serious misconception about the way this country really functions and where we are today in relation to 20, 30, 50 years ago. And secondly, what is really important to the United States about Mexico? On the first question, Mexico has made enormous progress over the last 30, 40 years. Economic, social, political, international, from all points of view. The second issue is that Americans don't often understand what the U.S. military, intelligence, and foreign policy community has always understood. The overriding U.S. interest regarding Mexico is Mexican stability. That is the most important thing. You know, there's a million Americans living in Mexico,
right,
not visiting, living here. I mean, do you really want Mexicans rioting and sort of going after them? Do you really want the Mexicans harassing the 30 million American tourists who come to Mexico every year? No. So you have to be careful not to have other less important interests, undeniable ones, but less important, get in the way of this overriding interest, which, by the way, has been intact and respected by both countries for over a century now.
Jorge Castaneda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Jorge Castaneda, Mexico's former foreign minister. This is Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
And all week we've been checking in on President Trump's first 100 days in office. The clock chimes at midnight on Friday night. How many campaign first 100-day promises has he fulfilled? Well, today we'll look at the pledge to clean up corruption in Washington, drain the swamp, as he put it. Here's Donald Trump, the candidate, in October.
It is time to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. This is why I'm proposing a package of ethics reforms to make our government honest once again.
Well, we asked NPR's Peter Overby to check out the swamp, and he did.
Going back to that speech, Trump spelled out his ethics reforms.
I'm going to reinstitute a 5-year ban on all executive branch officials lobbying the government for 5 years after they leave government service.
And Trump bars them forever from lobbying for foreign governments. At Taxpayers for Common Sense, Steve Ellis says that's good. But a really strong ethics program takes a different perspective.
Trying to make sure that people have the taxpayers' interests at heart when they're working in government.
Ellis notes the administration has hired industry lobbyists to oversee the industries they were working for up till now. Trump's Drain the Swamp plan also calls for Congress to pass new laws. One would target Washington lobbyists with foreign clients.
I'm going to ask Congress to pass a campaign finance reform that prevents registered foreign lobbyists from raising money in American elections and politics.
There's no real action on that front. John Pudner is director of a conservative good government group called Take Back Our Republic. He's a fan of draining the swamp.
This is a central topic to why President Trump won this election.
Pudner was talking from the interstate. He said Trump started strong, but needs to do more follow-up. Pudner also sees a problem. Trump's own decision to hold on to his hundreds of companies and not divest them while he governs the United States.
I think divestiture is the thing that moving forward calls into question what's being done, and I think that needs to be a priority still.
A battalion of progressive groups is already examining Trump's conflicts of interest. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington sued Trump as soon as he took office. Its president is Noah Bookbinder.
We and a lot of others are watching closely to see what his business interests are and how they evolve and what kind of actions he takes as president.
The White House told NPR that Trump has, quote, kept his promise of not being swayed by special interests as he attacks symptoms of the swamp, including overregulation and waste in government. Trump's director of management and budget, Mick Mulvaney, has suggested that draining the swamp is really about something else, making government smaller.
President Trump calls it draining the swamp. What it really means is making the government more accountable to you, more effective, and more efficient.
But if cleaning up Washington means less lobbying, that isn't happening. Since Election Day, the number of new lobbyist registrations is up compared with a year ago. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
We couldn't come to Mexico City without talking about two of the most famous Mexicans, the artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. They were married and divorced and remarried, and their relationship was dramatized in the 2002 film Frida, starring Salma Hayek and Alfred Molina.
I paint what I see, the world outside. With you, you paint from here. It's wonderful.
I can see why you're so successful with women.
To find out more about Frida and Diego, we went to the Anahuacalli Museum, designed by Diego, and met Carla Nino de Rivera and Jimena Jordan from the museum. I started by asking Jimena, what made Frida Kahlo so unique?
What makes unique is that she was inspired by the popular art style. So she integrated in her works of art the colors, the perspective or the non-perspective, and another features and symbols of popular Mexican art. And in that moment, or in the art history, artists didn't do that. Now they do.
She was very big while she was alive, also outside of Mexico. In fact, she and Diego lived in the United States for a while and did some art exhibits in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So what she was doing, you say, it had roots in Mexican art, but it translated around the world.
Yes, these icons and this way of expressing human emotions in a style that was not European intellectual style, but it was Latin American popular art style. So she integrated European techniques with popular art symbolism. That is why people in Europe and in United States were captivated by her artworks, because they were still European style artworks, but they were unique because they were expressing feelings in a language that in that moment was unknown to them.
She was also very political.
She was,
What were her politics?
Frida Kahlo, she was a revolutionist in her way of thinking. She was 3 years old when the revolution started. She was 7 years old when the main first period of the Mexican Revolution finished. She was always very proud of Mexico being a revolutionary nation. She thought that it was the beginning of a better start for Mexico and for the world.
Carla, let me switch to you now. Who was Diego Rivera?
Diego was an amazing artist. He was this kind of macho archetype, brave and proud about his Mexican thing. But he was also a great human being. He studied at the academy here in Mexico, and he broke with the academy and translate this knowledge to a new way of expression. Then he went to Europe. He met there Picasso, Modigliani, all these important guys, and they became friends, and they interchanged ideas. They were looking for the same things. With Picasso, both of them were embracing this ancient art to look forward to the future. He became to Mexico to this revolutionary period, and then he created with José Vasconcelos the muralism movement. So it's one of the most important things we have in Mexico. And
would you say that he is most famous today for his murals?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everybody knows Diego as a muralist, not maybe as a painter, as a small painter, but also muralist.
So how did they meet, and how did their marriage come about?
Frida Kahlo was at the National High School, and that high school, preparatoria, we call it here, in that moment, it was four girls would be there per 100 boys. Mm-hmm. Because most of girls wouldn't go to university, and Frida Kahlo wanted to be a doctor. So she studied really hard, and she was accepted in this national high school. And
here was Diego. Diego, when he came back from Europe, he were asked to paint the murals in the National Preparatory. So there he was painting, and then yeah. Frida appeared.
Frida knew Diego because she would go, as probably another classmates of her, to see Diego painting. And she would stare at him and observe him while he was working for a long time. But Diego didn't know her. And then Frida Kahlo suffered the accident.
A bus crash.
Yes, yes. That accident changed her life forever. So she was not going to be a doctor anymore because she became disabled. And then she decided to go into painting because it was a job that allowed her to manage her own timetables. Mm-hmm. And when she decided to become a painter, she was painting, and she painted some, you know, medium format artworks and took these paintings to Diego Rivera.
How did they influence each other's art?
I think they were in love. I think the love is the most important influence that they have in common.
Their love for each other influenced both of them. It wasn't that one of them was copying from the other.
Yeah. It's the most important.
How important are they to Mexico today?
Today, Frida Kahlo, because I think they are different in terms of,
yes.
I mean, maybe they are equally important, but in different way. Nowadays, Frida Kahlo is a symbol and is a model to people who has any kind of disability, because she was able to live a normal life in spite of her disability. That is very important. We have a lot of people with disabilities in the museum, and they are very touched and eager to see the crutches and the sticks of Frida and the wheelchair and everything. Also, she's very important for the LGBT community all over the world because Frida Kahlo was bisexual.
Right.
And when she was alive, bisexual women mostly conceal that condition, and they did not practice bisexuality openly. And Frida did so. And she did not feel ashamed of that. On the contrary, she felt that that was her. Also for the feminist community, she's important. Frida Kahlo did not join any feminist movement, but interestingly, current feminist groups want her as a symbol.
As an icon.
As an icon, thank you.
And what about Diego? How important is he to Mexico today?
I think Diego taught all the artists, not just in Mexico, that you can intervene in your nation's life. He was this activist guy. He was always trying to improve the daily life of all Mexicans. So he was known by being friends with Trotsky. He helped to bring Trotsky here. He was truly proud of being Mexican and our ancient culture, and he was always trying to show what we came from. That's why he made the Anahuacali. He collected 50,000 pieces because he was in love of our origins. So this is so important, not just for Mexicans, just for everybody, I think.
For human history.
Ximena Jordan and Carla Nino de Rivera speaking with us at the Anahuacali Museum in Mexico City about Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. You're listening to Here and Now.
The dispute between the U.S. and Canada over softwood, a dispute which is usually settled between the two countries in deals hammered out over decades, went public this week. Backing up, Canada sells timber to Canadian loggers from government-owned land at a pretty low price. The Canadians, in turn, sell it here in the U.S., where American lumber producers argue it should have a tariff slapped on it to make up for what they say is a government subsidy. Well, Tuesday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross obliged, announcing the U.S. would impose a 20% tariff on all lumber imported from Canada. But that lumber is used in home building, and so now that U.S. industry, home building, is upset. Andrew Miller is CEO of Stimson Lumber in Portland, Oregon. And Andrew, Stimson Lumber has been around since 1850. It goes beyond Oregon to Washington, Montana, Idaho. And you're pretty happy about this proposed tariff. Why? What's the harm to you of Canadian lumber?
It's pervasive over a long period of time. I mean, we're a capital-intensive industry, so the weight that the Canadian lumber places on our market on a continual basis, particularly in down markets, because the Canadians are highly incented due to their timber subsidies. And I think it's important that Commerce Department found that the Canadian industry is receiving 32 other subsidies in addition to the primary one of their timber. So those subsidies, when the markets are declining cyclically, just weigh heavily and drive pricing down to levels that are they're highly unprofitable. And mills in Oregon, including the mills that Stimson operates, have to curtail or close for extended periods of time. And that's been the cycle, really, for the last 30 years. In that environment, people are less inclined to hire. And right. Meanwhile, the Canadians are humming away at full employment.
Well, you know what the Canadian lumber people say. They say that in turn for getting these low prices for trees from public land in Canada, they put in the roads, they maintain the areas that they, you know, put in a lot of money themselves. They're not just getting a freebie. But also, what about these estimates by the National Association of Home Builders? That without that cheaper Canadian lumber, and it is cheaper, home building here in the U.S. would cost much more. There was an estimate by the National Association of Home Builders last year that a 15% increase, President Trump and his administration are talking about a 20% tariff, 15% would raise the cost of new homes by 4.2% here in the U.S. and cost 4,666 jobs.
You know, with all due respect, in this day and age, everyone's got their facts, and the home builders are just wrong, frankly, to some degree. They're just shills for the Canadian. I mean, the reality, for an average-size home, lumber for the last 15 years has made up 2% of the cost of a home. If 2% increases by 15 or 20%, that works out to a couple hundred dollars per home on an average home that's about $250,000. It's inconsequential. And people need to understand this is only the sticks that make up the framing. It's not the plywood. It's not the kitchen cabinets, the flooring, the doors, the windows. None of those are covered. It's only framing lumber. And interesting that the home builders should be complaining about this when their profit margin has doubled in the last 10 years.
Well, look, Vox is one of many publications that's reported on this. And as you well know, I don't have to tell you, this is one of, I think this is the seventh cycle of negotiations on this in modern times. There's a forestry professor at Yale who's quoted as saying it's like Groundhog Day because this has happened before. And, you know, sort of quietly, the countries come to an agreement. At one point, Canada did have to accept a 15% tariff. They put it on at their end. And then in 2002, the Commerce Department levied a 27% tariff. It went all the way to the World Trade Organization. The countries came to a deal. The U.S. had to give back some, but there was a tariff on the Canadian end. You know, people are saying that in this round, there probably would be a tariff put on this softwood again, but it's very public this time as opposed to other times. Do you worry that your industry is being used by the Trump administration to sort of, you know, have some bluster ahead of what might be a trade war with Canada?
No, this has nothing to do, and it's entirely separate. This is a long-running trade dispute. We're not seeking long-term duties. We're seeking a fair market share of about 22-23%. I mean, today, Canada has a 33% market share of the U.S. market. We need about 16% of their market share to supply U.S. demand combined with our own production. That gap between what we need of 16% and what's real today of 33% are jobs in the U.S. versus jobs in Canada.
Andrew Miller, CEO of Stimson Lumber there in Portland, Oregon, weighing in on this, you know, trade spat with Canada. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, from Canada back here to Mexico, Robin, mm-hmm. and before we head back to the United States, I have to tell you about the protests.
The protests?
They're not protesting us, but there are huge street protests.